would be with us. Amen. The study this afternoon is entitled In Search of Balance. It obviously comes from Hannah Weisberg's Shabbat Delights. This is one of her essays on this portion from the book of Leviticus. She writes, with so many demands tagging at us constantly, many of us are on a perpetual search for balance in our lives. We are looking to find that miraculous state of equilibrium and harmony that can draw the many facets of our lives inward. So then she quotes a passage from Leviticus 23, a passage you are no doubt familiar with. 6 days work shall be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a calling of holiness. You shall do no work. It is a Sabbath to God in all of your dwellings. From Leviticus 23:3. Now the work, which she does not go on to define in the article, is defined in some of the other studies that we've done. And as I've mentioned before, the sages define work in such a way so as to include everyone in the community. And they base their categories or their classifications of what work is to be prohibited on the building of the tabernacle. Because everything that was done in connection with the building of the tabernacle, like the dyeing of fabric, the casting of metal, the shaping of parts, the manufacture of the components of the tabernacle, all of those things were suspended on Shabbat, and so no work was done on Shabbat, and so they connect that to the construction of the tabernacle, although there are a few things specifically prohibited in the Bible itself. At any rate, she goes on and says, the 6 days of the week from Sunday until Friday represent the six basic directions of the three-dimensional physical universe, north-south, east-west, and up-down. They represent the fundamental modes of reaching out to the six directions of creation. This is obviously an idea from Kabbalah. But these six outward-bound directions could not exist without a center point. The Shabbat is the center point that draws all six points together. It is the axis or focal point at the center of the six directions. It reflects an inward look, representing how we integrate spiritual illumination into ourselves. All week long, she writes, in our struggle to gain spirituality, we operate in a masculine mode of conquest and assault, in a state of restlessness. Throughout these 6 days, we dominate and exert influence over our surroundings. We are in a constant state of conflict, choosing between those elements of our world that we are to embrace and develop, and those that must be rejected and overpowered. But every Shabbat, we enter afresh into a spiraling cycle of harmony, serenity, and peace. After having asserted ourselves and having accomplished our goals during the weekdays, we take a respite from our battles. Obviously, this is what Shabbat is intended to be. On Shabbat, we refrain from the selection and suppression process altogether. As we enter into a feminine mode within ourselves and within creation, a state of harmony, peacefulness, restfulness, and receptivity. For this reason, she writes, Shabbat is referred to in the feminine, as in Shabbat Hamalkah, the Sabbath Queen, or Kalah, Bride. And if you have been to a synagogue or have appreciated a synagogue service on Friday evening, these are references with which you are familiar, understanding that we welcome the Sabbath as the Sabbath queen or as a bride. There are even liturgical components in the Friday evening service that refer to this. What's interesting to me about this has to do with the fact that most people tend to think of God in masculine terms. In fact, we refer to him as Father, and obviously not so frequently or not so much as Mother. But the fact of the matter is God has both masculine and feminine attributes, and it's something that we can see in the celebration or the observation of Shabbat. Because Shabbat is something which kind of taps in, according to Hannah here, into a feminine mode within ourselves. Because we all have aspects of both in us as well. And she speaks of Shabbat, or entering into Shabbat, as entering into a state of harmony, peacefulness, restfulness, and receptivity, right? And that's one of the reasons why Shabbat is referred to in the feminine. But what's interesting to me is also the number of words in Hebrew that are characterized in the feminine. And I wanted to just mention a few of them so you would appreciate a little bit about the way this works, right? So Shabbat is referred to in the feminine, but so is Kehillah, the Hebrew word for congregation or community. As you know, Hebrew has masculine and feminine forms. All of the verbs, for example, have masculine and feminine forms. It depends on who they apply to. When you use a verb in Hebrew and are speaking of a woman, then you use a certain form of the verb. When you're speaking of a man, you use a certain form of the verb, right? You use the form of the verb that applies to the masculine or to the feminine that you're referring to. Obviously, there is more to it than that. There are forms for each of the pronouns, I, we, you, your, they, them, right? But when it comes to nouns, nouns don't have two forms, they have one form. Nouns are either masculine or feminine, but not both, right? So the word kehillah, the word for congregation or community, doesn't have a masculine form. It's a feminine word, right? The idea of gathering together as a congregation or as a community, you know, the idea that we gather together in a way that connects us to each other is a feminine concept in Hebrew, as obviously is the word chavurah, the word for fellowship, right? So you can see, based upon what I just said about the connections that take place or are supposed to take place in congregation and community, that the word chavurah, the Hebrew word for fellowship, would also be a feminine noun, okay? But the word ruach in Hebrew, the word for breath or wind or spirit, is also a feminine word. The expression Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, for example, right? The word Ruach, the word for spirit, is a feminine word. As it turns out, is the word Torah. That's also a feminine word, which is also interesting. The word Torah, by the way, it's never translated into the English word law in a Hebrew text, right, or in a text from a Jewish author, because the word law, our English word law, comes from the Greek word nomos, and nomos doesn't have a lot to do with Torah in Hebrew, right? In Hebrew, the word means teaching or instruction. But also the word simcha, the word for joy and gladness, is also a feminine term. As, interestingly enough, is the word milchama, the Hebrew word for war, is feminine. Now you would expect the word for war to be a masculine term, wouldn't you? Right? Except that in Hebrew, wars in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible, are not usually waged to expand one's borders, that is, to acquire more territory. If you look at the Hebrew word milchama, mem lamed chet mem he, right, milchama, the Hebrew word for war, it is waged primarily for the sake of what is central to that war, which is lechem, or bread, right? If you look at the Hebrew letters of the word milchama, you'll see that the middle three letters in blue form the Hebrew word lechem, which means bread. Deprived of the basic food staple, wars will be waged for economic or for moral reasons. In other words, to help the needy, feed the starving, assuage the pain of those who are hungry. It is not simply a commandment, it is the means of preventing war and securing the great blessing of peace, right? But this concept is an important one, because I can't think of any examples in the Bible where a war started by Israel, is intended to acquire territory, right? The Jewish people have a promised land. That was a land that was given to them by God. They have no interest. They had no interest then. They have no interest now of expanding their territory into other areas, right? I mean, they never fought a war to acquire territory, which you would associate or attribute to a masculine motive. But of course, that's not the reason for war in the Bible. Wars are only fought because we are attacked, right? We're attacked, we defend ourselves. But the idea here that deprived of basic needs, right, wars are fought for economic or for moral reasons, then it helps us to understand why milchama, the Hebrew word for war, is a feminine word. The word chokhmah, wisdom, is also a feminine word, as is the word binah, the word for understanding and discernment. In fact, there's a passage in the Talmud from Nida, and the Lord endowed the rib, the rabbis say, with understanding. A quote from Genesis 2. The verse indicates that the Holy One endowed women with more understanding than men. Right? Now, I could have listed a dozen passages here that speak to the same thing. The fact of the matter is that in Jewish thought, women are considered to have more understanding than men. They are more discerning. They are more understanding. Right? Which is one of the reasons why the word bina is a feminine, comes in the feminine form. Right? With regard to the verse in Genesis 2, the commentator takes vayiven, the word for made, as derived from bin, to understand. Right? Another word that is in the feminine is the word da'at, knowledge. So the words wisdom, understanding, discernment, and knowledge are all feminine. By the way, do you see the word chokhmah? Notice that it starts with a tough. The word binah with a bait, and the word da'at with a dalet. The first letter of these three words forms the acronym Chabad. Right? That's what Chabad means. Wisdom, understanding, knowledge. Right? So, Chabad is an acronym for Chochmah, Binah, and Da'at. All three words are in the feminine. They're in a feminine form. Right? So it's interesting that it works like that. And by the way, the last word, I could have listed, you know, another 50 or 100 that would have been interesting, but the word neshama, the word for breath or soul, is also a feminine word, right? So it's important, I think, to think of God as having both masculine and feminine qualities, and thinking of ourselves as having both masculine and feminine qualities. I think it's obvious that if you're a man, your masculine qualities tend to, well, not always, but sometimes tend to overshadow the feminine qualities, or the qualities which we associate with femininity. And if you're a woman, your feminine qualities overshadow your masculine qualities. But the fact of the matter is that we all have both, in my opinion. And frankly, there should be a balance, a kind of balance that exists between them, you know, because we frankly see the effects, the negative effects of situations in which one aspect of our nature is emphasized over the other. At any rate, Chana goes on to say, Shabbat is the source of blessing for both the week that preceded it as well as the one that follows. Similarly, in Judaism, a woman is considered the source of blessing for her home. Our sages declared, quote, a man receives blessings only through the merit of his wife. This is from a passage in the Talmud dealing with civil matters. There are three tractates. Bava Metzia is the second of the three. And joy, blessing, goodness, Torah, and protection come from the wife. Right? Notice joy is the word simcha, which we already said above was a feminine word. Blessing is berachot, which is also feminine. Goodness, tova, and Torah, these are all feminine words, right? They come from the wife. And this comes from the tractate on levirate marriage from the Talmud. This is because though you can have an abundance of blessing in your life, and this is a good insight, in my opinion. It really isn't yours until you are able to stop, appreciate, and absorb its goodness. Okay? And I think that is an important aspect of Shabbat and what Shabbat is for. Shabbat is, in part, about appreciating the abundance of blessing that exists in our lives, right? But we only appreciate that abundance when we acknowledge it, when we stop long enough to appreciate it and absorb its goodness. Similar to a passage in 1 Timothy where Paul writes, but godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it, right? So here's a passage in which contentment is regarded as having great value, Right? But contentment means to be satisfied with your blessing. Right? In other words, to acknowledge the blessing that God has given you and to take steps to appreciate it. That is the way that contentment, and godliness too for that matter, how they affect us in a positive way, right? Because frankly, and I'm going to make an obvious statement here, but frankly, it's possible to have a great deal and not be content, right? And not appreciate it, not be grateful or thankful regarding what God has given. And so one of the messages of Shabbat is to appreciate what you have and what you have been through to get you to the place where you are now. Right? That's a part of it too. And of course this passage reflects this statement in the book of Psalms, Psalm 37. Better the little that the righteous have than the wealth of many wicked. And from Proverbs, better a little with the fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. And also from the Proverbs, better a little with righteousness than much gain with injustice, right? So godliness with contentment is great gain, as Paul says. At any rate, on Shabbat, we can finally absorb the blessing of our previous week's toil, as well as invigorate ourselves to continue on the new journey of the oncoming week. We give meaning to the past while we renew our energies for the coming work week. The woman has been entrusted with lighting the candles to usher in this holy day, which is so representative of the feminine mode. Even if the husband wants to kindle the candles himself, his wife takes precedence. For the same reason, it is preferable for a man to recite the Havdalah prayer at the conclusion of the Shabbat, ushering in the weekday work which lies ahead, right? And you can see the contrast here between the woman lighting the candles to usher in Shabbat and the man saying the blessings at the conclusion of Shabbat, the Havdalah blessings that usher in the new work week, right? Because the pursuits that we typically associate with the work week, right, are pursuits that we think of more in masculine terms than in feminine terms. Typically, it obviously depends on what you do. But the point is that the woman lights the candles on Friday night and the man recites the Havdalah blessings at the conclusion of the Sabbath on Saturday night. Now, for what it's worth, if a man is not married or does not, if there isn't a woman in his life to light the Shabbat candles, then he has an obligation to light them, right? In other words, if there isn't a woman in his life to do this, then the man does light the Shabbat candles, but in the same way, right? So it's an interesting juxtaposition, though, of obligations or responsibilities. And then she concludes, with the many demands of modern life, we need the holy day of the Shabbat more than ever to bring blessings, harmony, and balance into our lives. And these are obviously things that that don't just happen on their own, right? Things that we have to address in our lives intentionally. Harmony, bringing balance into our lives. Now, as I was preparing for this study, I came across an article by Dennis Prager that I liked, and I added it, six reasons why keeping the Sabbath matters. It dignifies and elevates us all. Dennis Prager is a talk show host in Southern California. I don't know if his programs are you know, if they appear in other markets, but I have listened to him for years, and I've enjoyed listening to his broadcasts for many, many years. At any rate, he writes, in my fifth and final column on the greatest guide ever devised for a good world, the Ten Commandments, he writes, I offer my readers what may well be the best single thing you can do that you are probably not doing now to improve the quality of your life, your family's life, and ultimately the life of our society. Many people, even among those who revere the Ten Commandments, do not think that the fourth commandment, the Sabbath day, is particularly important, let alone binding. And obviously, this has to do in some way, and in a significant way, with the fact that for most of Christianity, the Sabbath day has been changed from Saturday to Sunday, right? So, this is one of the changes that was made by the early church fathers. Even though the Sabbath day is a fixed day in the calendar, it's not a floating day, it's a fixed day. It's the seventh day, right? The work week in Israel begins on Sunday. And the seventh day is the Sabbath day. It is not possible to change the seventh day to the first day. But that, in effect, is what has been done. The Sunday, not until the 4th century, by the way, although there are some rumblings with regard to this issue earlier, but not until the 4th century of the Common Era was Sunday regarded or recognized as the Christian Sabbath, right? And the seventh-day Sabbath was wholly rejected by the early church, right? So that's one of the main reasons why the fourth commandment, having to do with the celebration of the Sabbath, is not very important for most people, right? I mean, think about it. The Jewish people make up about half of 1% of the world's population, right? So the Jewish people outside the land of Israel are a minority every single place they live. But of course, the Hebrew Bible preserves this instruction. And Dennis goes on to say, once you understand it, however, you will recognize how both life-changing and world-changing it is. The fourth commandment reads, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Notice, by the way, that it doesn't say to make it holy. It says to keep it holy, because God is the one who made it holy. So the Sabbath is holy whether you observe it or not. It has nothing to do with you, right? The Sabbath was designated a day of rest by God. It was endowed with a holiness, a separateness, a distinctiveness that made it separate from the other days by God. So the commandment is to keep it holy. In other words, to guard it, to keep it, to preserve its holiness in your lives as well. 6 days you shall labor and do all of your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall do no work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, but notice also, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, right? It's interesting, of course, that the Sabbath is something that God intended for animals as well, and for foreigners residing or living among the Jewish people. And he goes on to say, here are six reasons why this is so important. Okay? So his first reason, it uniquely elevated the human being. For nearly all of human history, life consisted overwhelmingly of work. And frankly, it still does. In effect, humans were beasts of burden. This commandment changed all that by insisting that people cease working one day out of seven. In other words, we are more than beasts of burdens. We are intended for more than just working, right? That is why, in Jewish thought for the most part, when a person identifies themselves, they do not identify themselves on the basis of what they do for a living, right? As we tend to. Westerners tend to identify themselves based upon what they do for a living, right? So, for Westerners, a Westerner would say, I am a teacher. I am an electrical contractor. As opposed to saying, right, I am a person who loves to teach, which is why I do it, right? Or, I am a person who happens to be an electrical contractor, and I'm an electrical contractor because I have an aptitude for it, I'm good at it, and I can make the most amount of money in the shortest amount of time for me, right? That would obviously not be true for other people, right? It's only true for those who have an aptitude for it and can accomplish a lot in a little amount of time, right? But of course, for others, it might be something else, right? The point is that Westerners tend to think of themselves almost exclusively in terms of what they do for a living, right? And their sense of well-being comes from how successful they are at doing what they do for a living, right? So, if you struggle in your work, for example, this is a simplification, of course, but if you struggle with your work and what you do and the lack of appreciation you sense on the part of people above you in the hierarchy, you tend not to be very happy with your lot in life or where you are or what you're doing or what you feel like you are capable of accomplishing, right? It's an interesting phenomenon, but of course, in the Bible, what we do to make a living is regarded as secondary to who we are as a person and the things which we consider to be important. Right? And certainly in the rabbinic literature, one of those things which are considered to be important is the study of Torah. Right? So in other words, we work only as much as we have to in order to meet our financial obligations, and we use the rest of the time to invest in things which make us better people. That's the idea in Jewish thought. At any rate, second, no matter how materially poor we may be, at least on the Sabbath day, we are not just material beings. First and second are obviously related. The first one is that we are not a beast of burden. Ironically, not even beasts of burden are beasts of burden, according to the Torah, right? I mean animals, which do bear burdens during the week, they are also given the Sabbath off as a day of rest, because it elevates them too. But number two, we are not just material beings, right? We have a spiritual component. We are elevated. Recall that the commandment tells us to keep the day holy, not merely not to work. So the instruction is not just to not work on Shabbat, but to appreciate the significance of this, as it has been called, an oasis in time, right? An oasis in time. It is enough for animals not to work. We are to make the day holy. No matter what our circumstances, we must remind ourselves at least one day a week that we are sacred beings, right? We are set apart by God. The Hebrew word here would correspond to the English word saint. We are sacred beings. We are saints. People set apart by God for a particular work and purpose. We have a soul to feed, not just a body. And of course, the soul needs just as much feeding as the body does, right? But we typically, and it's possible to tell by my waistline, right? I typically overfeed my body and underfeed my soul, right? A common problem in our society. But I think Dennis makes an important point here, that there is more to us than the body. Third, more than any other commandment, the fourth commandment reminds people that they are meant to be free. As the second version of the commandments, the one summarized by Moses in the book of Deuteronomy, and by the way, the book of Deuteronomy, that's what Deuteronomy means, the second telling, essentially. It states, of course, in Hebrew, it's Devarim words, but it states, remember that you were slaves in Egypt. In other words, remember that slaves cannot have a Sabbath. Only free men and women can. In light of this, in the biblical view, unless it is necessary for survival, people who choose to work 7 days a week are essentially slaves. Slaves to work, or perhaps to money, but slaves nonetheless. The millionaire who works 7 days a week is simply a rich slave. Okay? Number four. Fourth, while the Bible could not universally abolish slavery, the Sabbath commandment greatly humanized that terrible institution and ultimately helped make slavery impossible. Prior to the Ten Commandments, by definition, a slave owner was under no obligation to allow a slave to ever rest, let alone to rest one day every week. Yet that is exactly what the Fourth Commandment commanded. Even a slave as fundamental human rights, right? One of them being a Sabbath day of rest. Therefore, a slave is a human being too. Obviously, for much of the history of slavery, slaves were not considered human beings. And the Bible is something that rectifies this perception that a slave is a human being too, and they also have certain inalienable rights as people made in the image of God, right? Which is one of the reasons why I, as well as the Jewish people generally, have such a reaction to racism as they do. Right? Racism is unequivocally opposed in the Bible, right? Every one of us is a human being. We are created in the image of God. The fact that we all look so different is absolutely and completely irrelevant, right? I mean, like Martin Luther King said, and I'm not sure if I'll quote this properly, but he talked about the fact that the character, the content of our character, is a lot more important than the color of our skin. The color of our skin, I just frankly don't understand it. I just don't understand why in the world it makes any difference to acknowledging who we are as people, right? Frankly, it's something which affirms the diversity that we find in God, not denies it, right? It should be a life-affirming difference, not a life-denying difference. It just is something which has always baffled me. I don't know how recently I posted this, but I posted on Facebook a couple of pictures. One was a picture of eggs, different colored eggs, a white egg, a brown egg, an off-colored egg, right? There was like four or five different colored eggs in this picture, right? But when the eggs were broken open, right, and put into a pan, they're all the same on the inside. They all have a yolk that's identical. All the yolks of these eggs are identical. And once the eggs are broken, you can't tell which yolk came from which egg, right? I mean, that's a good illustration of the way this works. At any rate, fifth. The Sabbath almost single-handedly creates and strengthens family ties and friendships. When a person takes off from work one day every week, that day almost inevitably becomes a day spent with other people, namely family and or friends. It has similar positive effects on marriages. Ask anyone married to a workaholic how good it would be for his or her marriage if the workaholic would not work for a day each week, and you can appreciate the power of the Sabbath day. Of course, not working a day each week also means not thinking about work a day each week, right? So, It's like the connection between the letter of the Torah and the spirit of the Torah, right? A workaholic does not stop working as long as he or she considers to work in their heads or in their hearts, right? Resolving problems, dealing with issues, right? Not working means not working. And not thinking about it either, right? Which is one of the reasons why in Orthodox community there is, a prohibition on engaging with electronics, the electronics that we use so frequently in our work, right? So, in an Orthodox community, for example, they wouldn't turn on a computer or a cell phone or, a television, right? This is something that they would restrict access to. And part of it has to do with separating themselves from the way the rest of the week works, right? So, it's kind of like the prohibition against driving on Shabbat, right? I have never, except on a few occasions, I have never lived close enough to a synagogue to walk to services on Shabbat, right? But when I did attend services regularly and stayed with friends overnight for Shabbat, right? And they lived close enough to the synagogue for me to walk. I did. and I enjoyed it very much, right? If I could walk to shul, to synagogue on Shabbat, I would every week, right? Because it's nice not to have to get into the car and drive somewhere. But the fact of the matter is that the Sabbath is a day that facilitates making connections with people, right? Because we are limited with regard to other things we can do. There are those who argue that without God commanding a Sabbath, people could surely decide on their own to stop working a day each week and to spend the day with their spouse, their family, and friends. But the truth is that almost no one does. There will almost always be some reason not to take the day off. An important work project, housework, shopping, etc. Right? I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with Christians over the years regarding holidays like Yom Kippur, for example. Right? I've had this conversation regarding the Sabbath too, but regarding holidays like Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, a time that we reflect on our behavior and confess our sins before the Lord and experience His forgiveness, right? I wish I had a nickel for every person who said to me, well, we're supposed to do that every day of the year, right? But, like Dennis Prager says here, but no one does. No one reflects on their behavior every day of the year. No one confesses their sin before the Lord. No one recognizes the forgiveness they experience in the Messiah, right? These are wonderful ideas. But the fact of the matter is that we tend to be so busy during the week that we really don't give consideration to these matters until we're forced to, right? By the death of a loved one, for example, right? I mean, how many of you who have lost a loved one wondered immediately after the burial, you know, if you could recall, what's the last thing you said to that person, right? Or, I wonder if I could have done everything possible to ease their transition from this life into the next, right? Is there anything else I could have done? What should I have done differently? I mean, when we lose our job, right? Those are the occasions. When we go through a divorce, those tend to be the occasions when we sit back and evaluate and wonder with regard to what could have been. How would this have looked different if, right? But the fact of the matter is that we don't do that very frequently. And Yom Kippur, as a holiday, provides us an opportunity to do precisely that, which is one of the reasons why it's so important, right? But of course, all of the holidays work that way. Building a sukkah for Sukkot and having meals, eating meals in a sukkah, you know, inside this flimsy structure, which is supposed to help us to appreciate God's protection, right? I mean, obviously, the walls of a sukkah don't even keep out a good breeze, let alone a threat of any kind, right? It's not like you can lock the doors of your sukkah, right? It's open. So the protection that we enjoy is a protection that comes from God, right? These are things which we need to think about periodically, and the holidays facilitate our ability to do it because no one thinks about them every day. Sixth, the Sabbath commandment granted animals dignity. Even one's animals had to rest one day a week. It is, to the best of our knowledge, the first national law in history on behalf of animals. And its benefits to animals surely went beyond a mandatory day of rest. People who felt divinely obligated to give their animals a day of rest were much less likely to treat their animals cruelly any day of the week. All six of these life-changing and society-changing benefits regarding the Sabbath are available to anyone. You don't have to be a Jew, a Christian, or even a believer in God to derive all these benefits. Though, for reasons noted, the reality is that those who believe in the God of the Ten Commandments are the ones who have kept the Sabbath alive. The God factor plays another role in the Sabbath. Just as faith in God brings people to the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath brings people to faith in God. In our secularized modern societies, very few activities bring people to a relationship with God as effectively as does devoting a day each week to the spiritual and not just the material. Not bad for one day a week. That's why the Sabbath is one of the Ten Commandments. No wonder that those who have it in their lives are often happier, with richer family lives, more serenity, a community of friends, and yes, even better health. So, Dennis concludes his article there. That is another reason why I thought that the article was so fitting, is because of his comment in the last few paragraphs, right? You don't have to be a Jew, a Christian, or even a believer in God to derive these benefits from observing the Sabbath. They accrue to anyone who observes the Sabbath because it facilitates balance in our lives, which is often so desperately needed in our lives, right? So I'm going to stop here and see if there are any comments. Earlier there was a Shabbat Shalom from Rivka, from Watina, from Wanda, from Bethann, from Elaine Kirkland, to everyone. Shelley had to remind me to turn on the closed captioning. I have a note. See, I have a note on the top of my computer screen to turn on the captions, right? So I mostly see it. And sometimes don't. But it's like, anyway, I appreciate the reminder. By the way, if any of you notice that I have not turned on the closed captions, then please tell me to. Okay? I appreciate it. Elaine said that she's sorry, but she has to leave. And that's Shabbat Shalom to everyone. So Elaine had to go. Okay. That's all of the comments that we got during the study. Any other comments or observations about what we talked about?
Bob, I have, I guess it's more of a question or just to try to get your idea on the fact of something that's really specific to the Shabbat, in certain Christian circles. When Yeshua said the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath, that is used as a license to, to decide, well, that doesn't, we can do whatever we want to with the Sabbath as long as, we use that phrase. And so it took away a lot of the, so if you could kind of go into what that actually is talking about a little bit, that would be.
Yeah, okay. The occasion of that statement occurs in relation to the healing of someone, right? Someone that Yeshua healed on the Sabbath. And there were some, not all of the Pharisees or the sages, but there were those who regarded healing as a work which was prohibited on Shabbat. Okay? It's not a work, ironically, which is prohibited on Shabbat by most. In fact, you know, you have probably heard it said, you know, that if a donkey falls into a ditch and it happens to be on Shabbat, what do you do? Do you leave it in the ditch until the next day? No. You help it out, right? I can remember the rabbi of the synagogue that I attended in Southern California on one of the occasions when his wife was pregnant. He, her water broke on Shabbat, and he needed to rush her to the hospital for the delivery of the baby, right? What did he do? He put her in the car and drove, right? This is a Chabad rabbi. They don't drive on Shabbat. They don't even ride in a car on Shabbat. So he drove his wife to the hospital, right? Because he needed to get her there as quickly as possible, right? But because it was still Shabbat, when all of the dust settled, did he drive home? No, he walked home. Right? He drove his wife to the hospital in the car, but he walked home because it was still Shabbat and he doesn't drive on Shabbat. In other words, the laws of the Sabbath are set aside when someone's life is endangered, right? But of course, there are those who would say that healing someone on Shabbat is one of those activities that can wait another day. What's the big deal, right? But of course, if you're the one with the disease, right, then an extra day is an incredibly big deal, right? So that was the circumstance during which Yeshua spoke about the fact that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. It was intended by God to be a day when we take a break from things, right? But there are obviously occasions when it is not possible to take a break from those things. When I was working as an electrical contractor, there were occasions, of course, when someone would call me and they would have an emergency on Shabbat, right? And they would expect me to come over to their house and to fix it, right? But I was the one who determined whether it was an emergency, not them, right? So if the circuit, for example, went out that powered their refrigerator, I would tell them, you know, get an extension cord and plug it in somewhere else. And I'll come over tomorrow morning, first thing, and fix it, right? But I don't need to set aside my... And everybody knew that I did not work on Saturdays. So it wasn't like, oh, you can't come today? What's wrong? Right? Everybody knew that I didn't work on Shabbat. The point is that what was an emergency for them was not an emergency for me. If it would have been considered, if I would have considered it an emergency, then I would have, right? I would have done something about it. I remember on one occasion, during a service for the evening of Rosh Hashanah, I was at a place, a facility, celebrating one of the evening holiday services, and the power went out to the entire building. Right? So, the services stopped, essentially. Everything went dark. So, I'm an electrician. So, I went over to the main panel to see if I could figure out, you know, what had happened. Right? I mean, what else was I supposed to do? So, the person who was responsible for the event got a flashlight, and we went over and walked over to the main panel to see if it was something locally that could be repaired or fixed easily, right? Maybe a circuit breaker tripped. I can reset a circuit breaker, right? Even on Shabbat, if it facilitated our ability to continue the service, right? So the idea, of course, is that some people would say, oh no, right? You can't trip a circuit breaker on Shabbat or reset a circuit breaker, or you can't heal on Shabbat because their restrictions overshadow what the Torah intends through this Sabbath legislation. And Yeshua helps us to appreciate what the Torah intends, right? In this case, that the man who needed to be healed, healing him was not a violation of the Sabbath provisions, right? Because the Sabbath was made for us. It was intended for our well-being, which is one of the reasons, as we discussed today, why we should take advantage of it, right?
But Bob, don't you see, or have you ever encountered the person saying, though, that was proof that Yeshua was antinomian, that he did not, you know, that the law was, he proved right there that the law was not binding upon believers.
Right, but unfortunately, that doesn't prove that. It proves the opposite. It proves that the Torah is very important in our lives, right? But there are occasions, like on this occasion, that life takes precedence over it. Like in the Orthodox rabbi's decision to drive his wife to the hospital on Shabbat. Some things take precedence over Shabbat, right? But it's the difference between an exception and an exemption, okay? Christians tend to think of exceptions. Jews tend to think of exemptions, right? Like the speed limit on our highway. The speed limit for most highways is 65 miles an hour, right? How fast can a police officer drive on the highway? He has to obey the speed limit. He has to drive 65 miles an hour. He cannot drive any speed he wants. He has to drive 65 miles an hour or less, unless there is an emergency. If there's an emergency and he flashes his lights, then he can drive as fast as he needs to get to wherever he's going or to apprehend a criminal, right? Someone who is breaking the law, right? But it's an exemption that only applies to the emergency. When the emergency is over, the normal speed limit applies to him just like it does to everybody else, right? It's the difference between an exemption. An exemption is when you can do something on a temporary basis, right, because of the circumstances. An exception is when that rule doesn't apply to you, right? An exception would be, I'm a police officer, I can drive whatever speed I want to on the freeway, and it's none of your business. But the law does not have that kind of exceptions. It has exemptions. But the fact that there are exemptions means that the force of the Torah is in place. It hasn't been done away with. In other words, if Yeshua would have imagined that the Torah would have been done away with, there would have been no point in that entire conversation. Right? I mean, what's the point of saying this is an exemption if there is no more Torah? Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, and of course, anybody who would make a comment like the one you just suggested obviously does not understand one whit regarding what the Jewish people believed about the Torah, including Yeshua, and his disciples in the first century. Right? Because the Torah is eternal. How do you get rid of something that's eternal? You don't. Shabbat is eternal. Yom Kippur is eternal. Passover is eternal. These holidays, you know, God says of each of them that they're eternal. They don't go away. Certainly, not by the coming of the Messiah. And so Amy writes, would these examples show the spirit of the law over the letter of the law? And Amy, I would say that these examples, the examples I've mentioned, are examples of the connection between the spirit of the law and the letter of the law, right? But in the example that David mentioned, those who opposed to the healing on Shabbat were people who emphasized the letter of the Torah over the spirit of the Torah. And in Yeshua's teaching, that is never the case. It is always, they are always combined. Yeshua always combines the reason behind why we do what we do, or the meaning connected to it, to the instruction itself, right? But frankly, it's a lot like what Hannah said about Shabbat, right? It's not really enough to stop working on Shabbat, right? Part of what the Sabbath involves is letting that momentary calm have an impact in your life, right? Now, it obviously does to different degrees in our lives, but the point is that there is more to the Sabbath than putting a closed sign up on the place where you work, right? It means, you know, when you go to a store and they're closed, have you ever gone to a store? You go to a hardware store, okay? Or a pharmacy, and you pull on the front door and it's locked, and then you notice the closed sign, right? But when you look through the window, you notice there are still people working on the inside. Have you ever noticed that? I mean, in places like Home Depot, they have a whole night crew, right? They reorganize, they inventory, they move things around, right? They clean, right? There's a whole crew at work at night, right? So the place is only closed to the public, right? They haven't stopped working. It's just closed to the public. Well, if what you do on Shabbat is just put a close sign on the door of your heart, but you're working on the inside, you're not celebrating or observing Shabbat. Right? You understand what I mean? That's the whole point of this, is that there are, with all of the commandments, there are internal ways of applying these principles to our lives, right? And that was something that we see in the life of Messiah, right? That's why the sages say that when the Messiah comes, he'll help us to appreciate what the Torah means, because he will live it out in his life, in a way that in the way Moses intended, right? So, any statement like the one David you mentioned is an affirmation of the Torah, not a negation of it. It affirms the Torah. It doesn't negate the Torah. If Yeshua negated the Torah, he's not the Messiah. Right? If Yeshua did away with the Torah, he's not the Messiah. That's all there is to it. Because that's not something the Messiah does. It's something that the Christians teach Messiah did. But that's not something you see in any Jewish literature. Right? Including the apostolic writings, including the New Testament. It's Jewish literature too. Okay, any other comments?
Yeah, Rabbi, I had a question.
Yeah.
Because the statement that you made at the end of the lesson about the Sabbath being, you have to be Jewish, or, you know, the Sabbath is meant for everybody. But if you don't acknowledge it, the Sabbath, do you still get the blessings from, I mean, the whole purpose of the Sabbath? Do you still get that if you're not,
acknowledging it? I think on some level, resting on Shabbat provides a benefit, right? Provides a benefit to people. And like Dennis says here, he said it doesn't really make any difference what your motive is. That the rest, if you rest on Shabbat, it has a corollary benefit in your life, right? Of course, the more you believe in the reason for the Sabbaths being given, you know, the more you're going to benefit by the purpose behind it, right? So, in other words, if you not only rest on Shabbat, you know, but take that time to deliberately or to consciously separate yourself from the work week, and to recognize that there is more to you than what you do for a living, right? In my opinion, there are additional benefits that accrue to people who appreciate what the meaning of the Sabbath actually is, right? And they do things like on Shabbat, for example. It's okay to play a card game. It's just not okay to keep score. Right? Have you ever played a card game and didn't keep score? I don't know how many of you play card games, but there are many card games which are incredibly competitive. Right? Board games generally can be very competitive. Right? But on Shabbat, you completely eliminate that competitive aspect of the game and just try to enjoy the game for what it is. It's a game, right? And frankly, if you try that, you'll find that the card game, it's more fun because you've removed this competitive element from it, you know. You don't have to prove anything anymore. You can just play the game because you enjoy that game. Right? It's that idea. So, from Joseph, the discussion with Yeshua regarding his healing on Shabbat did not pertain to whether or not Shabbat was negated. It was an issue of what was permitted or forbidden on Shabbat. Right? So, this is a comment that Joseph makes, but he makes the same point I was making earlier, right? That the teaching has nothing to do with whether or not Shabbat should be regarded as important. It has to do with what was prohibited and permitted on Shabbat. That was the issue, right? But as I said earlier, it actually attests to the validity of Shabbat. Otherwise, the discussion is meaningless, right? If Yeshua did away with Shabbat, then any discussion having to do with Shabbat is meaningless. You know, it's frankly, it's one of the things that has always troubled me. You know, Paul, for example, makes a comment about, you know, we are justified by faith in God, right? Not by anything we do. Okay? So, how does he prove his point? He quotes from the book of Genesis and speaks of the kind of relationship that Abraham had with God. Right? I mean, if Paul taught that the Messiah did away with the Torah in his death and resurrection, then why on earth is Paul quoting from it to prove a point? Right? That Abraham trusted God and that trust was reckoned to him as righteousness. Right? I mean, either the Torah provides an authentic commentary, you know, or it doesn't. Right? But if it's done away with, it doesn't. So what's the point? There are hundreds of quotes to the Torah in the apostolic literature. Right? Nobody knows this because they don't, because the quotes aren't in the text. They're in footnotes. In good Bibles, they're in footnotes. In many Bibles, they're not even in footnotes. You would never know that it was a quote from the Hebrew Bible if they didn't have quote marks around it, right? But very few people bother to look these passages up and to see what passage an apostolic author is actually quoting from to prove his point, right? But if these passages are used to prove a point, then they must be valid. They must still, in Paul's time, or in Peter's time, or in any of the other authors' lifetimes, they must still be regarded as authentic and valid for living. Otherwise, what's the point of quoting from them? Right? Why doesn't Paul quote from Socrates, or Plato, or Aristotle? Right? Trust me. He knew what these guys said too. Right? But when he quotes from something when he wants to affirm that an idea or a concept is true, he relies exclusively on the Hebrew Bible to make his point. Right? Because it's still considered valid. It was still considered valid for him. I just don't get it. You know? There are some things I understand and disagree with. And then there are other ideas, theological ideas in particular, that I just don't get. And that's one of them. Right? It's like an oxymoron to me. Doesn't make sense. Right? Good. Any other comments before we go? Yeah, Tina, you had one.
Hey, Bob. Just a couple comments. I want to say that I love Dennis Prager. I love the videos that Prager University makes. I catch them on, like, the Facebook feeds.
Yeah. So.
I really enjoy them. And I want to say that it was interesting to learn that Shabbat is referred to the feminine, as well as the other words that you were going over. And then when you were going over the one that was about war, I say this jokingly, my mind immediately went to that saying that says, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned." And so, but then you explained that it was the deprivation of basic food.
Yeah.
And asking for economic and moral reasons. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's, that is, you know, helping the needy and feeding the but I just thought, okay, you just don't want to piss off a woman. start a war.
Yeah, that's a good observation, although I'm not sure that's a part of what the word means, but that's a common expression or idiom here in the West. But although it probably has a counterpart in all cultures, maybe. But yeah, I think, you know, the other thing which was important about that statement has to do with the fact that if we had the capacity this is going to sound a little crazy, I guess, but if we had the capacity to enrich people's lives in a meaningful way, right, then maybe there would be less conflict in the world, right? I know. It sounds like an answer that you get from a 6-year-old when or an 8-year-old when you ask them, you know, what do you want for your birthday? You know, world peace, right? But the fact is, it's sad that that we put such an emphasis on acquiring as opposed to facilitating, right?
This was a great study. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Appreciate the comments. Anybody else before we go? Go ahead, Amy.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Like, I have a Bluetooth speaker on, and sometimes you have to shut that off. What the comment you just made about acquiring versus facilitating, that wasn't my comment. You just said it as I was waiting. But when the thing about war being feminine, like Tina said, hell has no fury, but I was thinking of the mother bear robbed of her cub.
Oh, yeah.
And just the robbed of, as far as, I guess in this reference, bread. If they don't have bread, they're going to die. But I was thinking the moral influences on our cubs, you know, the things that come at them, and the mother wants to fight against anything that she perceives as a threat.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good analogy. The idea of a mother bear feeling threatened on behalf of her cubs. But that puts the idea of war, you know, into a completely different category than the acquisition of territory category, right? The acquisition of territory is just, you know, we're going to war. I mean, listen, when you think about history, when you think about, you know, when you think about, you know, the wars that involve Rome, or, you know, all of these conflicts, or most of the conflicts, you know, through the ages, have been to exert influence and acquire territory, right? I mean, even Hanukkah, our story of Hanukkah, is about an occasion when Antiochus Epiphanes, the ruler of Syria, tried to impose Greek culture and values upon the Jewish people as a people, right? And of course, we had absolutely no interest, right? But what motivated him to do that, or to imagine that it would be welcome? Why on earth would he imagine that, you know, the Jewish people that have been a nation for, you know, 2,000 years before he came along would find would find anything he was doing appealing or attractive, right? He was motivated by greed, by acquiring territory, securing the land bridge between Asia and Africa, right? It was all about power and influence and control, right? He couldn't care less about the people, his own people, or the people of the territory he sought to acquire, right? So, he was not a mother bear, right? He was a conqueror. And unfortunately, wars frequently fall into that category. It's sad. There's a few other from Angela. Okay, from Angela. It's interesting coming out of Christianity how we completely ignore these obvious things that we are learning now. I agree, and I appreciate you saying that, because we talk often about cognitive dissonance, about ideas that that don't fit prevailing ideas in our hearts, and that is typically the way they're reacted to. They're ignored, right? You ignore information that doesn't fit your paradigm. Yep, until, of course, if you have an open heart and that information slowly and gradually has an impact, then you get to a place where, oh, yeah, that, look at that, where things jump out at you, right? You've been reading the Bible for 30 years, and something jumps out at you that you never saw before. Not because you didn't read it, right? But because you weren't in a place to see it, right? It's a big, big deal. So thank you for that comment from Wanda. I often wonder, would people know what to do with themselves? This is a good one. If there was peace on earth, would people know what to do with themselves? I would hope they would find the love that is in their hearts. Amen. I would hope that they find that too, but good observation. Obviously, there's no way to really answer it, but I'm not sure that... I mean, obviously, some people would really appreciate it, right? But there are others who would, who would try to convince the rest of us that it wasn't the peace that we were really looking for, right? From Amy, good point, Wanda. She says, Ange ignored or by God's providence not permitted to see yet. Right, so obviously can be either one of those. By the way, there is information, like Daniel was told to seal up some of his writing until the end, because people wouldn't be in a position to recognize or to see it until the end, right? So there is some truth to that idea too. From Rivka, I have a simple Sabbath answer for people. Go look on your calendar and count which day is the seventh, right? Yeah, that's a good one. Right in front of our eyes everywhere, if we have eyes to see. Yep. The first day of the week is Sunday. The Sabbath is the seventh day. From Beth Ann, this has been a wonderful study and discussion and comments. Thanks, everyone. I especially liked your analogy about the closed sign on the door. Baruch Hashem. Yeah. Yeah, the Sabbath means more than putting out a close sign on your front door, right? Definitely more than that. Very good. Appreciate the comments. Anything else before we go?
I have one other comment.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Yentl.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a scene, you're talking about the understanding, the woman having a more spiritual understanding or prone to more spiritual understanding. Reminded me of the scene toward the end of the movie where Abigdor realizes that she's a woman, and he says, "Why would you deceive us in such a way?" And she said, because I wanted to study Torah, and women aren't allowed to study Torah, or apparently in that situation. And he said, but you're a woman. You already understand everything.
Yeah, that was a... That insight is based upon this idea that we talked about, right? But of course, nobody understands everything, and everyone should be given an opportunity to explore issues that they have in their lives, right? Deal with questions. Everyone should have the opportunity to do that, right? So men and women both should have that opportunity. So, by the way, in biblical times, there were women. There were women who studied Torah. Yeshua had women disciples. They're never referred to as disciples by the church, right? But they were disciples every bit as much as the others were. There are women scholars in rabbinic literature. One of my favorite stories in the rabbinic writings is the story of a woman who walks a considerable distance to get to a synagogue where she enjoys the teaching, right? And the rabbi, of course, notices her presence in the synagogue each day and her participation in the discussion. And he says, "Woman, I mean, why do you walk?" He knew where she lived. "Why do you walk so far, right, to participate in a service, right, or in a study?" And she says, because here I receive the reward for my steps. In other words, she didn't feel like the rabbi at the synagogue that was closer to her, right? He didn't say anything that was particularly meaningful for her, right? So what's the point of going? What's the point of sitting into a study where you're not really learning anything, right? So it's a great story, Part of the reason why I like the story is because it's a woman. And it is evidence of the fact that women in biblical times participated in studies, right? So, in Yentl, that knowledge was used to restrict a woman's participation in studies, right? That obviously was not the way the comment was intended, right? Right. The rabbis said that women were more discerning than men. The rabbis never say that women can't learn anything at new,
right?
Right. Very good. Anybody else before we go? There's a couple of chats. Beth Ann mentioned about the study, and Ed says, agreed, Beth Ann, a wonderful and applicable study and discussion. Amen. Baruch Hashem. The discussion is the enjoyable part for me. Very good. Anybody else before we go? Okay. Well, There is still a little bit of a Shabbat here, and probably maybe where you are, since it's getting dark now so much later. Unfortunately, thanks in part to daylight savings time. But anyway, so I'll say Shabbat Shalom. I can do that in the summer. And Shavuot Tov. Have a good week, right? So God bless you guys. Good to see everybody.
God bless you, everyone.
Everybody.
Look forward to seeing you on Wednesday and Thursday this week, both nights. Okay? God bless you guys.
Bye.
Bye.